additional steps for some time, a major obstacle stood in our way: the wrongful imprisonment in Cuba of a U.S. citizen and USAID subcontractor, Alan Gross, for 5 years. Over many months, my administration has held discussions with the Cuban government about Alan's case and other aspects of our relationship. His Holiness Pope Francis issued a personal appeal to me and to Cuba's President Raul Castro, urging us to resolve Alan's case and to address Cuba's interest in the release of 3 Cuban agents who've been jailed in the United States for over 15 years. Today, Alan returned home, reunited with his family at long last. Alan was released by the Cuban government on humanitarian grounds. Separately, in exchange for the 3 Cuban agents, Cuba today released one of the most important intelligence agents that the United States has ever had in Cuba, and who has been imprisoned for nearly 2 decades. This man, whose sacrifice has been known to only a few, provided America with the information that allowed us to arrest the network of Cuban agents that included the men transferred to Cuba today, as well as other spies in the United States. This man is now safely on our shores. Having recovered these 2 men who sacrificed for our country, I'm now taking steps to place the interests of the people of both countries at the heart of our policy. First, I've instructed Secretary Kerry to immediately begin discussions with Cuba to reestablish diplomatic relations that have been severed since January of 1961. Going forward, the United States will reestablish an embassy in Havana, and high-ranking officials will visit Cuba. Where we can advance shared interests, we will, on issues like health, migration, counterterrorism, drug trafficking, and disaster response. Indeed, we've seen the benefits of cooperation between our countries before. It was a Cuban, Carlos Finlay, who discovered that mosquitoes carry yellow fever. His work helped Walter Reed fight it. Cuba has sent hundreds of healthcare workers to Africa to fight Ebola. And I believe American and Cuban healthcare workers should work side by side to stop the spread of this deadly disease. Now, where we disagree, we will raise those differences directly, as we will continue to do on issues related to democracy and human rights in Cuba. But I believe that we can do more to support the Cuban people and promote our values through engagement. After all, these 50 years have shown that isolation has not worked. It's time for a new approach. Second, I've instructed Secretary Kerry to review Cuba's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism. This review will be guided by the facts and the law. Terrorism has changed in the last several decades. At a time when we are focused on threats from Al-Qaeda to ISIL, a nation that meets our conditions and renounces the use of terrorism should not face this sanction. Third, we are taking steps to increase travel, commerce, and the flow of information to and from Cuba. This is fundamentally about freedom and openness, and also expresses my belief in the power of people-to-people engagement. With the changes I'm announcing today, it will be easier for Americans to travel to Cuba, and Americans will be able to use American credit and debit cards on the island. Nobody represents America's values better than the American people, and I believe this contact will ultimately do more to empower the Cuban people. I also believe that more resources should be able to reach the Cuban people, so we're significantly increasing the amount of money that can be sent to Cuba and removing limits on remittances that support humanitarian projects, the Cuban people, and the emerging Cuban private sector. I believe that American businesses should not be put at a disadvantage, and that increased commerce is good for Americans and for Cubans. So we will facilitate authorized transactions between the United States and Cuba. U.S. financial institutions will be allowed to open accounts at Cuban financial institutions, and it will be easier for U.S. exporters to sell goods in Cuba. I believe in the free flow of information. Unfortunately, our sanctions on Cuba have denied Cubans access to technology that has empowered individuals around the globe. So I've authorized increased telecommunications connections between the United States and Cuba. Businesses will be able to sell goods that enable Cubans to communicate with the United States and other countries. These are the steps that I can take as president to change this policy. The embargo that's been imposed for decades is now codified in legislation. As these changes unfold, I look forward to engaging Congress in an honest and serious debate about lifting the embargo. Yesterday, I spoke with Raul Castro to finalize Alan Gross's release and the exchange of prisoners, and to describe how we will move forward. I made clear my strong belief that Cuban society is constrained by restrictions on its citizens. In addition to the return of Alan Gross and the release of our intelligence agent, we welcome Cuba's decision to release a substantial number of prisoners whose cases were directly raised with the Cuban government by my team. We welcome Cuba's decision to provide more access to the Internet for its citizens and to continue increasing engagement with international institutions like the United Nations and the International Committee of the Red Cross that promote universal values. But I'm under no illusion about the continued barriers to freedom that remain for ordinary Cubans. The United States believes that no Cuban should face harassment or arrest or beatings simply because they're exercising a universal right to have their voices heard. And we will continue to support civil society there. While Cuba has made reforms to gradually open up its economy, we continue to believe that Cuban workers should be free to form unions, just as their citizens should be free to participate in the political process. Moreover, given Cuba's history, I expect it will continue to pursue foreign policies that will at times be sharply at odds with American interests. I do not expect the changes I'm announcing today to bring about a transformation of Cuban society overnight, but I am convinced that through a policy of engagement, we can more effectively stand up for our values and help the Cuban people help themselves as they move into the 21st century. To those who oppose the steps I'm announcing today, let me say that I respect your passion and share your commitment to liberty and democracy. The question is how we uphold that commitment. I do not believe we can keep doing the same thing for over five decades and expect a different result. Moreover, it does not serve America's interests or the Cuban people to try to push Cuba towards collapse. Even if that worked, and it hasn't for 50 years, we know from hard-earned experience that countries are more likely to enjoy lasting transformation if their people are not subjected to chaos. We are calling on Cuba to unleash the potential of 11 million Cubans by ending unnecessary restrictions on their political, social, and economic activities. In that spirit, we should not allow U.S. sanctions to add to the burden of Cuban citizens that we seek to help. To the Cuban people, America extends a hand of friendship. Some of you have looked to us as a source of hope, and we will continue to shine a light of freedom. Others have seen us as a former colonizer, intent on controlling your future. José Martí once said, "Liberty is the right of every man to be honest." Today, I'm being honest with you. We can never erase the history between us, but we believe that you should be empowered to live with dignity and self-determination. Cubans have a saying about daily life. No es fácil. It's not easy. Today, the United States wants to be a partner in making the lives of ordinary Cubans a little bit easier, more free, more prosperous. To those who have supported these measures, I thank you for being partners in our efforts. In particular, I want to thank His Holiness Pope Francis, whose moral example shows us the importance of pursuing the world as it should be, rather than simply settling for the world as it is. The Government of Canada, which hosted our discussions with the Cuban government, and a bipartisan group of congressmen who've worked tirelessly for Alan Gross's release and for a new approach to advancing our interests and values in Cuba. Finally, our shift in policy towards Cuba comes at a moment of renewed leadership in the Americas. This April, we are prepared to have Cuba join the other nations of the hemisphere at the Summit of the Americas. But we will insist that civil society join us so that citizens, not just leaders, are shaping our future. And I call on all my fellow leaders to give meaning to the commitment to democracy and human rights at the heart of the Inter-American Charter. Let us leave behind the legacy of both colonization and communism, the tyranny of drug cartels, dictators, and sham elections. A future of greater peace, security, and democratic development is possible if we work together. Not to maintain power, not to secure vested interests, but instead to advance the dreams of our citizens. My fellow Americans, the city of Miami is only 200 miles or so from Havana. Countless thousands of Cubans have come to Miami on planes and makeshift rafts, some with little but the shirt on their back and hope in their hearts. Today, Miami is often referred to as the capital of Latin America, but it is also a profoundly American city, a place that reminds us that ideals matter more than the color of our skin or the circumstances of our birth, a demonstration of what the Cuban people can achieve, and the openness of the United States to our family to the south. Todos somos americanos. Change is hard in our own lives and in the lives of nations. And change is even harder when we carry the heavy weight of history on our shoulders. But today we are making these changes because it is the right thing to do. Today America chooses to cut loose the shackles of the past so as to reach for a better future. For the Cuban people, for the American people, for our entire hemisphere, and for the world. Thank you. God bless you, and God bless the United States of America.
You have been listening to live coverage of U.S. President Barack Obama speaking about changing U.S. relations with Cuba. You can get more information on this story by visiting our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. In other news this hour, Pakistan is mourning the loss of more than 140 people, mostly students, in a terrorist attack on a military school in Peshawar Tuesday. Reporter Ayaz Ghul is there and spoke with us a little earlier today.
I am right now located on the outskirts of Peshawar in a graveyard where the principal of the school that came under attack, she was buried just like a few minutes ago, and there are hundreds of people attending the funeral ceremony at this moment.
Can you tell us what you see?
Well, right now, it's a very sad situation here in this community. We see a very large number of people have come and attended this funeral because this principal, the story that her relatives have narrated, how she bravely stopped the militants who were trying to break into the room where she was together with several students and female colleagues. And she was in front of all those kids and staff members, but the terrorists, they burst, they basically broke into the room, they smashed the door, and then they, from point blank, you know, they shot each and every person in that room, including this female principal of the school.
And there are many other sad stories.
Yeah, I just was in one of the main hospitals, Lady Reading Hospital here in the center of the city. I spoke to two brothers. In fact, I spoke to one of them. One is critically wounded. He received a bullet right in his face, and his doctors are struggling to save his life. Whereas his other brother, they were all both taking their chemistry exam at the time of the attack. And the other brother who received one bullet in his thigh told me that basically their teacher locked the room as soon as the gunfire erupted, and they did not open the door, but obviously the terrorists, the attackers had grenades, and they again smashed the door, entered the room, and this student just told me that he was the first one who received a bullet, and then he fell unconscious. And when he woke up, he said there was a two-year-old daughter of one of the teachers who was also the teacher was holding at the time. She was dead, and eight or nine other people, including two teachers and students, they were all dead. And then somehow he managed to take out his cell phone and called his father. And then 2 hours later, security forces rescued him. But he is now safe. He's undergoing surgery right now on his left thigh.
Is there fear that the Taliban may return?
Well, no, obviously we see an unusual, unprecedented security around the city right now after this major tragedy. But obviously the entire city is giving the look of a very sad town where in each and every corner you can see funerals or people have gathered to pray for those who have died in this tragic attack. And it's like quite a sad situation that I'm witnessing around me.
Any talk about the future?
Well, the security, the military has come under severe criticism. The political leadership, they are being criticized because Pakistan has been fighting this war against terrorism for more than a decade. And still, if an installation which is run by the military, even though it's a school, but there are army officers whose kids also study in this school, if that could not be protected, and even though the fact is that this city is located right at the mouth of the tribal areas, which are strongholds of the militants, then obviously it has raised a lot of questions whether other installations around the country can be considered safe. But what we see here is an unusual development, is that the Pakistani military chief, General Raheel Sharif, and the Pakistani ISI chief, Lieutenant General Rizwan, they both have suddenly rushed to Afghanistan to meet Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and the ISAF commander there. And the military has told us that it is a special visit, and it has led to speculations that the attackers were having links with Pakistani fugitive Taliban commanders who have allegedly taken refuge on the Afghan side of the border, and from there they plotted this attack. So these are the speculations. We don't know, but the visit of the Pakistan Army Chief together with the country's intelligence agency chief is unprecedented in the history of the country. So it shows that maybe it will fuel again those tensions between the two countries as a result of this attack that have subsided recently because of the visit of Afghan president recently that has left behind a very good good atmosphere to help both the countries reduce tensions. But it may not be the case sooner or later if there is no cooperation between the two countries on how to deal with these kind of terrorist forces.
Well, thank you very much for your observations today, Ayaz.
Thank you.
That was Ayaz Ghul in Peshawar earlier today. The government of Pakistan Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has lifted a moratorium on the death penalty in terrorism-related cases. A de facto moratorium on civilian executions has been in effect since 2008. The Pakistani Taliban said its fighters attacked the Army public school and college in retaliation for the military's offensive against insurgents in the country's northwestern tribal region near the Afghan border. Samina Yasmin, a Pakistan-born political science professor at the University of Western Australia, speaking with VOA's Victor Beattie from Islamabad, was asked, what possible justification would the Pakistan Taliban have for carrying out Tuesday's attack?
One interpretation is that they want to make it very clear that if the military operates in the federally administered tribal areas, especially in Waziristan, that they can shoot indiscriminately at the younger generation. But other than that, I think what most of the discussion is surrounded around is how they've been using the name of religion and jihad to kill even the youth. You know, it's such a horrible tragedy that I find people just bursting into tears. There's actually not any understanding. Even for somebody like me, I can't get out that why would anyone do this? But if we go back to what happened to Malala Yousafzai, I think they tend to think that giving, quote-unquote, a message really makes it useful for people to know that they are serious about what they're saying. But I hope that the way they have engaged in this terrible tragedy is going to really make sure that the government and the military and even other political parties get together and they try and respond to it accordingly.
Can you give me a sense as to whether or not this will unite the Pakistani people against the Taliban?
I think we hope that it will, but the trouble is that Pakistani politicians, they tend to all get together and condemn such a... But then a few weeks down the line, they go back to their own little ways of ensuring that they want to be in power. There's no guarantee, but I just think it's necessary that they do, because it's such a horrible incident that if that doesn't bring the country together, especially on the day when Pakistan, as we used to know, was divided in 1971, if it doesn't wake them up and doesn't get them to rethink what they're doing, what it would really indicate is that Pakistani political elite does not really care about Pakistan.
Will this be a turning point in Islamic extremism worldwide?
I hope so, but I'm not so sure, because if you look at how Boko Haram has been operating, they have also tried to attack schools. And basically their strategy, which I think a lot of these groups have started evolving, has been one of targeting the younger generation, targeting the educational institutions. And though there hasn't been a lot of mass murders like the one in this case, I think the fact that it's happened, unless and until the Pakistani government, military, and everyone else responds to it, it could be sadly a turning point with other militant groups to think that that is the way to go. Because when we think about the barbarity that's been going on in Iraq and Syria, even that indicates that at one level militants don't have a limit. If we're thinking about how the governments around the world would be looking at Muslim militancy after this incident, they might get more serious about responding to it. But when we think about the responses of the militants themselves, I think they could go either way, and that's really my fear, because it could tell them that that's another space in which they can be even more active than they've been so far.
Yasmin says she is heartened by the reaction of Muslim scholars who, along with the Taliban in Afghanistan, have denounced the attack as un-Islamic. Rafiq Dosani, a South Asian analyst with the RAND Corporation, says Tuesday's attack in Peshawar sends a strong signal that the Pakistani Taliban, under relentless pressure from the military, is not yet vanquished.
The army has been relentlessly after them for the last 6 months, and all the signs were that there had been great progress. I think something like this shows that there has not been as much progress as the army was making it out to be, but in some sense it also shows a certain level of desperation by the terrorists.
Do you anticipate finally some strong reaction from Muslim leaders worldwide who have been relatively silent during this era of terrorism?
You know, Muslims have been quite strong about denouncing it, particularly Muslims who live in democracies. I think those living in dictatorships have, for various reasons, whether they are rulers or whether they are citizens, been scared to proclaim their disgust for such things, but that's more because it affects their personal safety. But, you know, you loudly see the leaders of, say, Indonesia, Muslim leaders in India, in Bangladesh, in Pakistan also. All these democracies are very clear about what they feel.
Do you anticipate a strong reaction from world leaders from the West to take on these terrorists in a more vigorous fashion than has been done so far?
The Pakistani government has followed a two-pronged approach. So what it's done is, on the one hand, had all these quiet negotiations with the Taliban. At the same time, the army on the other side has been pushing hard on the military side, sort of as an offensive. And the question it raises for President Obama and other leaders of the West who have been advising Pakistan on their strategy and trying to help them as best they can is this the end of the negotiating part of the strategy, or should the door still be kept open? And that's a very difficult one to answer, because clearly talking is ultimately going to solve the problem. You are pretty unlikely, given the amorphous nature of the Taliban, that purely military offensive will ever succeed.
Dosani expects Tuesday's massacre will make Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif's effort at accommodation with the Pakistan Taliban more difficult, while strengthening the military's more aggressive anti-militant campaign. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.